Advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you've tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
Johnny Hodges, Alto Sax, welcoming us to the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and I've taken that movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. I don't think I have to remind too many WBAI listeners that the Attica prison uprising ended 50 years ago today. The four-day rebellion against intolerable conditions in the maximum security prison was put down by New York State police and correctional officers who fired more than 2,000 rounds into D Yard, where the rebels had made their stand. 39 people died that day. 29 of them were prisoners. 10 of them state employees, both guards and civilian workers. All died of bullet wounds. That was despite a claim made by a representative of Governor Nelson Rockefeller, who authorized the deadly assault. The claim that the state employees had died from having their necks cut by the inmates. That lie, and it was a lie, went around the world before it was proved false, and that was thanks to a brave local medical examiner who autopsied the victims and determined that death was due to gunfire. And even state officials admitted only one side had guns. For those of us who were watching from afar at the time, the deadly uprising at Attica was one of the most wrenching events we'd ever seen. The photos of troopers and their rain slickers armed with rifles pointed at hundreds of men who'd been stripped naked and forced to lie in pools of rainwater and blood. Those images have stayed with us ever since. But for those who were present during that attack, we can only try to imagine what they endured and the kind of wounds they left. Albert Victory was one of the people in D Yard that day. Mr. Victory was serving a prison sentence for felony murder involving a police officer. It's a crime he long insisted he played no role in, of which he was innocent, but for which he nevertheless served 36 years behind bars. I met Mr. Victory in 2014 when I was reporting a series of articles for the Marshall Project in the New York Times about conditions at the prison. It's a long story, but let me just say that Mr. Victory has lived a remarkable life on both sides of the bars. And to give just a taste of that life, I will say that Albert Victory is a native of Brooklyn, raised in Brighton Beach, is likely the only person to have been on the FBI's most wanted list and have also received a special commendation of thanks from the New York State Corrections Commissioner for helping to save the lives of prison guards. Al Victory, thanks so much for taking the time, and welcome to WBAI. You there, Al?
Thanks for having me, Tom. Yeah.
Let's start.
Thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure being with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. I'd like to start with the conditions at Attica in September 1971 that led to the rebellion. Al, what were they? What were the things that people were most upset about?
Well, Attica was really, no kidding, effectively a Ku Klux Klan farm, as far as the correction officers went. They really were, really, literally, all of them were white. There was no black or even Latin gods working there. And they just, this was their personal fiefdom. This is where they ran, you know, effectively, they treated us like slaves and like, even worse than slaves. You don't beat slaves because you want them to continue to survive. But in Attica, it was just the cult of personality in regard to the gods. And they had complete control, and they beat people, and they murdered people, and the usual stuff that I know you want me to highlight. I was fortunate because I'm Caucasian. So I more or less wasn't one of the targets as much as the blacks and Latinos were. So I sort of was able to skirt the edges of being abused. But I was a witness to it all. And it was really, you know, a terrible, frightening experience I'm trying to think of specific events. Okay, let me.
And some of it, Al, some of it was pretty tangible, right? I mean, you were limited to one roll of toilet paper per month. What did you do when you ran out?
Well, you literally either you used a newspaper, and or if you had some commissary money, let's say you were working, if you weren't locked up, so you could earn some money, you could go buy in the commissary some toilet paper. Otherwise, literally, you use toilet paper.
And one shower a week? Do I have that right?
That's correct. That's correct. One shower a week. Hmm. And like I said, I was a Caucasian, so I had a plum job, so to speak. I was a feed-up man in C block. So I was a witness to just about everything that went, you know, anything that went on.
Tell us what a feed-up man is. What does a feed-up man do, Al?
Well, when guys were key block in the block, I was in C block, I would literally go to the mess hall, pick up food for everybody that was locked up in the block, and deliver it to the guys' cells, because they couldn't leave their cells and they couldn't go to the mess hall, so I had to feed them in their cells. So I had plenty of contact with the guards, and I would listen to them I'm trying to give you a
did they talk openly around you because of the fact they considered you a white man?
Yeah, they sort of did. I mean, I was always still an inmate, you know, as far as they were concerned, and never quite on par with what they believed themselves to be. But I know I'm giving you a bad interview here, but
no, you're doing fine, Al. Doing fine. Just
all right. Well,
I'm glad to have you, and I'll just keep
so
feeding you a few questions.
I don't know how to put it all in a nutshell for you.
You don't have to put it in a nutshell. Let me ask you this though: in the days leading up, the uprising began on September 9th, but before that, there was an episode involving. After George Jackson was killed by police on the West Coast,
I think that was on August 27th, I believe.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
All right.
But I believe that's when that happened.
And there was a response by folks at Attica to that, wasn't there?
Right. Everybody, all the inmates, went to the mess hall and refused to eat. They took their spoons and they took their trays. And they went into the mess hall. They didn't talk. And all the guards were literally, they knew there was a big problem coming. We all knew there was a problem. Prior to that, we had asked Commissioner Oswald to come into the facility and change things, give us more toilet paper if you want to laugh about it. But that was a big deal for a lot of people
sure.
that didn't have. So in protest against what they had done to George Jackson in California, we went to the mess hall. We were silent. We refused to eat. And that particular day was the one very rare occasion when they made chicken for everybody and mashed potatoes and corn. best meal they had all year.
and people wouldn't eat it. That's a pretty remarkable example of unity, isn't it?
That's a big deal, yeah. Yeah. It's like I said, it's the big best meal of the year that you could get in Attica.
And that shows how angry people were, I guess.
Right, and how serious this was. We wanted some change.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was, frankly, we were having meetings in the school, and whenever we could, we would have secret meetings amongst inmates from different blocks. How we did that, I could explain, but it'll take a few minutes to do all that. But anyway, we were literally, all the leaders from all the different blocks were meeting, because we had to change. We had to change this facility. We couldn't continue to live like this. It was a matter of life and death for most of us.
How long had you been at Attica at that point? Had you been there a while? Was it about a year? How long were you there?
I had been there about a year and a half, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Attica different from places you had been before?
Attica was all the way up state. Yeah, I was at Greenhaven. I was in every maximum security facility there was
sure.
in the state of New York. But Attica was special. It was, for some reason, as soon as you walked into place, you knew that this was a place that you could literally get killed in by the guards. And just the atmosphere,
You told me, Al, when we spoke back in 2014 when I was interviewing you for my articles about current conditions at Attica, you told me that if you did something that resulted in discipline being sent to the box, which is the term for solitary, of course, that you're almost inevitably going to catch a beating as you were brought down the halls from guards. Was that was part of normal life?
That was part of the processing of people into the segregation. If you were going to go to segregation, they wanted you to know that you were going to be punished. And they punished you on your way there. And in the elevator, they would beat the shit out of you.
Okay, we're going to watch that. All right, go ahead.
You're going to watch what?
Just the word. Just the word, that's all.
Oh, okay.
They were going to beat you severely.
They were going to beat me or anybody that they were taken up to the box civilian. It was a given.
Uh-huh.
It was part of the process of going into the box. You automatically caught, you. If you were lucky, you only caught a couple of smacks in the back of your head because they made you face the wall of the elevator when you went up. So the guards that were escorting you up to the box would literally, considering what charge you had, like this, let's assume for at the worst, if you had a charge of being disrespectful to a guard or maybe even pushing a guard back, let's just say, for a minute, you were definitely going to be, if not, literally killed, you were going to wish you were, because you were going to be beaten so badly, this was the rule. This is what happened every day there. And I was in C Block, which was the gateway to where you had to go through to go to the box and go segregation, if you want to call it that. So I would, and whenever they were escorting somebody from other blocks, like A, B, D, and D, they would have to come through the hallway right past where I was in C Block. And I was out most of the time because I was a block porter, a block feed-up man. So I was literally right there witnessing it all almost every day.
Hmm.
They would close up the hallways and just whoever they took out of whatever block they took them from, they would beat them down through the halls right past C Block where I was. So I couldn't help but see it.
Couldn't help but see it, right.
All the time, every day.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM, folks. You're listening to the show. It's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. But more importantly, you're listening to Albert Victory, who was one of the people present in D Yard 50 years ago today when the Attica Rebellion was put down with a bloody assault by state troopers and correction officers as well on the orders of then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller. Let's talk about sort of the hopes and fears during the days leading up to the 13th. I mean, I know that the uprising kicked off almost like spontaneously, but once you were in the yard and people were getting organized, what was the spirit for the first couple of days?
Well, I'm going to step back a moment.
Go ahead.
Because prior to the 13th, like I said earlier, we were all the leaders in throughout the prison from different blocks were meeting secretly and making you know, tentative plans to somehow have some effect on what life was like in Attica. So we had tentative plans of literally taking over the prison if necessary. Hopefully we wouldn't have had to, but that we were ready to do that. However, on the 13th itself, that was spontaneous.
No, that was the 9th, you mean, or the day that it kicked off,
the 9th,
September 9th, right?
On the 9th, that was spontaneous. But that was spontaneity only lasted a short time, because all the leaders from different blocks, we all were now in D Block Yard. So when we first got there, also with some of the hostages, the guards, and civilian workers, once we got there, we had to organize. But we were semi-organized because we had had meetings about this. So even though it happened spontaneously, it was part of what we were going to do anyway. We just didn't know when, how we were going to do it, and we didn't have a concrete plan. But once we realized it was on, so to speak, we organized the yard, and we, you know, and security and inmate guards.
Well, let me just ask you, Al, just to clarify. Okay, in the opening hours of the uprising after it began, there was some grievous attacks on some of the officers. One of whom later died. That I take it that was not part of the plan.
No, that wasn't part of the plan. And I don't know that was they convicted two guys for that, which ultimately I think was commuted by Governor Carey later on. But
the officer did die. His name was William Quinn.
He did die, but I was led to believe, I wasn't there, I didn't see it, but I'm led to believe that it was just a matter of they ran over the guards because they were just, you know, when you first begin something like this, everything's wild. Nobody knew what was going on for the first...
You used the phrase when we first spoke, Al. You said it was like a wildfire. Like just a wildfire that was spreading through the prison as it began.
Well, it was. It was, like I said, it was spreading long before September 9th. We were determined that we were going to not live this way anymore. And then once it jumped off, so to speak, we were all... It was a day of freedom. We all knew we were going to pay for it at some point, but it was, you know, it was, we just couldn't take it anymore.
Well, let's talk about that for 1 second then. You knew you were going to pay for it. Well, did people talk about what they expected to happen if the prison was retaken by the troopers and the other officers?
Well, we all knew what was going to happen. Frankly.
Well, did you think they were going to shoot, or did you think they were going to come in with batons? Several people said
We didn't think they were going to do it the way they did. They just came in from the roofs and shot anything that moved, shot everybody. They shot over 100 and something people. I'm not even sure the exact number of how many people were shot in that yard, including guards and civilian.
You caught a couple of shotgun pellets yourself, didn't you?
I caught two of them, yeah. I was wounded and I never got any medical attention until I was shipped out of Attica. to Comstock, where I was finally treated.
Well, before that, Al, one of the things that, let's just talk about some of the almost legendary moments that took place in that period of time, and briefly, one of them was that the officials denied that they singled out anyone for punishment after they retook, but I think you told me that you heard police shouting for Sam Melville, the white radical who was serving time at Attica and who was involved in the defense. Do you remember that?
Of course I remember that. Yeah, not only him, but they were also calling for Jerry the Jew.
Rosenberg, the jailhouse lawyer?
Yeah, Jerry the Jew Rosenberg. Because he had been on TV a lot, talking, about how we were, we had a right to rebel because we were being treated like animals.
But Mr. Rosenberg was not killed. Sam Melville was killed. Was it your sense that he was singled out and then executed?
Absolutely. Him and also L.J. Clark.
Barkley?
L.J. Clark. Yeah, Barkley.
Right.
Barkley, yeah. Uh-huh. I'm getting old, so...
No, that's okay. So am I. Welcome to the club. But,
I understand, so.
But that's a pretty cynical thing to have witnessed. I mean, not only that they would come in with guns that you had not expected that they would even need to use and that they didn't use. I mean, nobody had a gun, am I right, among the prisoners?
Of course not. There was no gun. The only guns that were there were from the guards. And they were the guns that they brought in were their own personal guns,
right?
By the way.
Right.
They were literally shooting, I don't even know the calibers, but really serious, not something to wound. This was to kill.
Right.
The ammunition they used was for killing.
Right.
Hollow points and all of that stuff.
While you were in the yard after they retook it, you want to describe what happened? I know that at one point you saw Frank Big Black Smith, as he was called, lying on a table with a football under his chin. Did you think that he was alive or what?
He was alive. We all knew that. They were throwing cigarettes at him. They were literally burning him. And they told him if he ever drops the football from his neck, they're going to shoot him with a shotgun. And, they did it right. That was in front of everybody, in front of the commissioner. They had people coming in from Albany, and there was Big Back Smith being burnt with cigarettes right in front of them. There was no, and anybody that was in that A block yard, having been moved from the D block yard to the A block yard, then you had to walk into. Well, you know what it is, Tom. There's so much to tell.
Yeah.
I don't know what's more important.
Well, okay. Let me just see if I can do some leading questions. But my understanding is that after you were brought in, is that someone having a conversation in the background there, Al? Is there?
Yeah.
Okay. A speakerphone? Maybe they could just lower their voice a little bit. We could hear you more clearly that way. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Yeah, no problem. I didn't realize you could hear that.
Okay. All right,
in the other room, by the way.
Okay, all right. But you were then marched down what was later became called the gauntlet. What was the gauntlet now?
Well, every inmate that was in the yard literally was moved from D block yard to A block yard, where we were forced to be totally naked, crawling in mud and blood. And then one at a time they would let us into the hallway, which led to the A block, where the cells were, where they put everybody in A block at that point. And that hallway was littered, not because it was glass there, but because they literally broke bottles and put glass all over the floor for the hallway. So you have to, when you went in there, you had no shoes, you had nothing, no clothes, or nothing. So, and on both sides of the hallway, you had guards with either axe handles and/or their
batons.
But their batons were always like 2 feet long. It wasn't like a normal baton that you'd see, in, you know, in literally with a police officer in the street, and or in another facility. That kind, those kind of the kind of clubs that they had were really, you know, meant to injure and break bones and everything else. But anyway, you had to run through two sides of guards on both sides that were whacking away at you with these big sticks and or axe handles. And literally you were getting knocked to the ground, in, onto the floor with all glass. And when you try to run away to try to get through, to get to the block so you can get away from these guards that were beating you with these clubs, you had to run over glass. So everybody that went through that gauntlet came away, had that glass in their all their feet. They were all covered, they were all bleeding from the glass that they had to run over to try to get away from the guards that were beating them with clubs. So it was something that you could describe, but you could never really imagine, because you wouldn't think that anybody would do something like that to anybody.
Did you think at some point, I'm not going to survive this?
When they started shooting, I said, they're going to kill us all here. This is like, because they were shooting anything. They were shooting everybody. And when they saw somebody that was already wounded, they were still shooting them. You know, but they were literally shooting their own people, too. They didn't care who they shot. It seemed like. Maybe they just really didn't know, because the inmates had put green clothing on the hostages. So they looked like other inmates. So, you know, they could say, well, we didn't know that we were shooting our own people. But they had to know, because they were kept in a certain area, literally being protected. And we had a if you want to call it a squad or a group of Muslim inmates that was literally surrounding the guards to keep them safe. They were the safest people in the yard. If their own people didn't shoot them, they wouldn't have had a scratch. But as it turns out, they shot everybody, anything that moved.
Now, after you were driven through the gauntlet and you were thrown into a cell, was it your old cell? Where did they lock you up?
No. We were all thrown into brand empty cells in A block, where and we were literally four, five, six people in any cell that we were in.
And that's a cell that was designed for no more than two?
No more than one.
One.
Cells were only designed for one.
Okay.
There was, at that point, they hadn't yet had double celling.
So there were as many as half a dozen people in a cell intended for one person. How long did you have to stay there under those conditions?
And everybody was bleeding and or shot. And nobody wanted to go to the hospital, because if you left the cell, you were going to get beaten again through the holes. So anytime they get an opportunity to have an inmate, especially alone, they would beat them like, you know, they thought they had a license. I like to believe that they thought that inmates had stabbed the guards and things like that, or they like to believe that. But as you mentioned earlier, it turns out that a single guard was injured by an inmate. Was stabbed by an inmate. It was all about shooting done by the guards themselves and the state troopers.
Well, I think there were three guards who actually did have neck wounds, but none of them fatal. Everybody who died, the civilian and guard employees, died from bullet wounds and the bullets that were fired by state troopers and other police, correction officers, and others. So, Al, we're going to take just a brief musical break here for a couple of minutes. There was a lot of music that was created in the wake of Attica, and I don't think any was more eloquent than this piece by Archie Shepp, the great saxophone player.
Thank you.
Archie Shepp called it, that was his Attica Blues Big Band, Cry of My People. I'm talking with Al Victory, who was one of the veterans who was witness and wounded during the retaking of Attica Prison by state troopers on September 13th, 1971, 50 years ago today. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. My name's Tom Robbins. The show's called Deadline NYC. Al Victory, you were interviewed by officials at some point who were looking for you to ID people to start prosecuting. Well, how did you respond to that?
Well, they took me out of the cell and they brought me up to the top floor in A Block, where they had Fail, the deputy superintendent at that time, who was conducting interviews with different lieutenants and different civilians from out of Albany, maybe BCI, which is the Bureau for Criminal Investigation. They were trying to, they were interviewing every single inmate that they could get to try to make, you know, have them give information against other inmates. So when they brought me there, I just says, well, listen, I don't know. I had nothing to do with any of this. I was, you know, what am I going to say? I don't know anything about anything. I can't help you people. I didn't see anything that anybody committed any crimes. As far as I know, we were all trapped there together. And I can't be helpful to you folks. And they beat the shit out of me.
Okay, we're going to...
I must say that word. I know
that. All right, okay. But that's what happened. All right.
That's what happened. Then they literally threw me down the stairs. And number one, if you remember, I was, as you also mentioned, I was convicted for the felony murder of a police officer, which I wasn't guilty of, but I won't... That's neither here nor there. But having had that label attached to me, as far as they're concerned, I was a cop killer, which is a terrible thing. I mean, even the words are a terrible thing to say. But I was literally considered that. So I was a prime target for them. So they felt they had they could get me to say anything.
You told me that while you were in your cell, that Jerry Rosenberg, the jailhouse lawyer called Jerry the Jew, was not too far from you on the cell block, and that he was also singled out for special brutality.
Yeah, he was taken to the box shortly after the retaking of the prison, and they literally, they really actually gave him morphine for years because of the injuries that he suffered from the guards.
And this was not during the retaking. This was hours after the retaking.
This was hours after when they brought him up to the box, and they kept him there for for a year, maybe 2 years. I'm not even sure how long. But he was literally, of course, he was targeted. And I wish my mind. My memory was as good as it used to be.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you were singled out because of your refusal to cooperate. Jerry Rosenberg was singled out because of his notoriety and other things. In the days that followed must have been a period of terror. How long were you held in that cell with so many other prisoners before being rehoused somewhere?
2 weeks.
How do you survive in a cell with half a dozen people for 2 weeks? I don't even understand how you can do it.
Well, one day at a time.
One day at a time. Good enough.
One day at a time.
One day at a time.
Right. And it's all, your adrenaline never leaves you. You know that you're up against life and death. And, whatever's in front of you, you deal with as best you can. They tried to get me to because they knew I was very close with Jerry Rosenberg. They tried to get me to specifically say something that would implicate Jerry Rosenberg and or some of the other leaders that were more prominently out front in front of the television cameras and things like that. So they were looking for people that would name and give them some specific information about the leaders that were at the table who were negotiating, trying to resolve this whole issue before But
they knew what they had done in terms of the act, what they had seen on TV. Were they looking to connect them with other crimes? Were they looking to connect them with the death of Officer Quinn? What did they want you to give them?
They didn't care. Didn't matter. And, you know, they would say to me, well, number one, I wasn't even listening, frankly. I would just say, listen, I don't know what you're talking about. I can't help you. And I would get cracked in the back of my head or in my face or, you know, what do you mean? I was Jerry Rosenberg and I were very close friends. And the truth is we used to attend the meetings prior to the events, to the rebellion, together. And they knew that. So they wanted to get me to testify against Jerry Rosenberg and the other leaders. And that was what their main purpose was, to try to get inmates to cooperate and implicate some of the leaders that were more prominent.
Well, let me just try to draw a picture for folks who are listening to this. I haven't seen you in a few years, Al, but my memory is that you're not a big guy. Are you 6 feet, 200 pounds? I don't remember exactly. How big are you?
No. I'm like 5'10", maybe 5'8" and a half now because I'm starting to shrink.
You're like me. You're shrinking. All right.
I weigh in about 170, 5'10".
But that didn't have much to do with it, the fact that you were not exactly of linebacker size. They were still coming after you just as hard and heavy as they could at that point.
Yeah, but the truth is, they literally took every single inmate and brought him up to that to be questioned and to try to get them to testify against other inmates. Obviously, some inmates agreed to do it. And later on, you don't mind my jumping ahead of here a little bit, because I was in C block, literally, you know, where the a couple of officers were taken out of the office in C block and brought to as hostages to D block. The lawyers for the inmates that were charged with kidnapping those guards located me because I was literally locking next door to the office where the officers were taken hostage. Hmm. So they tried to get me to testify against those inmates to say that they're the ones that did it. And I said, I don't know who the name, I don't know nothing about it.
Did they offer you anything for, like, hey, we'll support your parole? Did they say anything they'd help you in any way if you did it?
Well, that was a given. If I would have cooperated, I would have been in Walkill the next week, the week after that. Hmm. Everybody that cooperated was sent out of there, sent to the best prisons they could go to, and literally given parole and time cuts.
So that was the reward.
That was the reward for testifying against other inmates. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the lawyers located me and asked me if I would be a witness for these inmates that had been charged. And I had, of course, truthfully, the smartest thing I could have done, and all the other inmates, including the Attica brothers, said, don't get involved. If you do, you'll be targeted for the rest of your life. Don't do it. But I had to do it because these guys that they had picked out to be charged with kidnapping, they weren't the ones that did it. They weren't the ones that kidnapped these guards. So I literally testified, it doesn't matter over whose objections, but I testified on behalf of the inmates, got them all acquitted. And then in another trial, the Shango trial, I don't know if you know who that is, Bernard Strobel, I think, I testified at his trial, and he was acquitted also.
Well, so let me understand this. You were still incarcerated at the time that you provided testimony to help with the defense of people that the state was trying to convict for what they said were crimes committed during the rebellion. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what was the upshot? What were there ramifications for having given that testimony, did you think?
Well, for 2 or 3 years after that, I was targeted, no matter where I went, phony charges, thrown into the box, took years before that stigma that I had of being, you know, a witness for the inmates against, so they saw it, and it was against the guards, as far as I'm concerned. I would have been, because I did testify to what they had done to the inmates, you know, along with my other testimony about, you know, that they weren't guilty of the charges, which got them all acquitted. But I also implicated them in all of the crimes that they had committed prior to the events on the 9th and after. And so I was, you know, I was an angry person, too. I was angry at what they had done. And I felt that I had to tell the truth. I couldn't allow them to convict people who didn't do it. And even though I paid a little bit of a price.
Was it worth it?
Yes, it was. I couldn't have lived with myself. Because I remember, again, this, I don't want to make it about me, but I had been really convicted of something I didn't do. So I just couldn't let somebody else go through the same thing that I did. Be convicted of something that they weren't guilty of. So I felt very proud of that, even though I paid it a price.
As well you should. You encountered... I want to talk in a couple of minutes about you, because you returned to Attica years later, and I want to talk about what you saw there. But I'd like to first off just get you to talk for a minute about, in retrospect, how do you feel about those 4 days? Was it worth it? I mean, was it something you would have done differently?
It was exhilarating, Tom.
Exhilarating.
Because we had been. When you're literally beaten like a dog and ordered around like a dog and live like a dog and know that you can't do anything about it, otherwise they're gonna just kill you. Really, that was the given situation in Attica. So when we finally made a stand and took hostages and demanded some changes, you know, it was a chance to be human beings again, to live like them, even though it was for a short time, and even though we knew we were going to pay a terrible price, it was exhilarating. Even if it was for 1 day, 1 hour, it was all worth it. And we did change the system. I'm not saying it stayed that way, but for the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the Attica Rebellion, everything changed throughout the state of New York. They literally, effectively granted all the demands that we had made, which we had made literally to Oswald prior to any of this happening. He could have stopped it all. Had he paid attention and changed just some of the things, you know, but he didn't. And, you know, was it worth it? Yeah, it was worth it because it reminded us that we were more than just numbers. We were people. We were fighting for our just for our humanity. And you know, and even though most of the folks there weren't political, we became political in an hour. You know, even if you never thought of politics at all in your life, once you were in that yard, you knew this was all political. This was the real deal, and we decided this was going to be our rebellion, and we did. We fought for it. We knew we were giving blood for it, and we were very proud of it. I'm a proud Attica brother, by the way.
There's Albert Victory eloquently talking about his feelings about having taken part in the Attica Rebellion of September 1971 that ended 50 years ago this morning with a bloody retaking by state troopers on the orders of then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but more importantly, I'm talking to Albert Victory, an Attica brother who was present there in the yard, who's been sharing with us his experiences and the horrors, as well as the honor of having taken part in that rebellion. Al, some years later, you were still in the clutches of the criminal justice system, and they sent you back to Attica sometime in the 1990s. What was that like, and was it very different?
Well, it was... it was different, yeah. They had, remember, we had literally had made an, had an impact on the entire New York State criminal justice system as far as prisons can go.
And you could see the results of that once you got back to Attica? Was there the same level of fear and of violence at the time?
No, it was a lot at that point. It went back to the fear and injuries and assaults and even killings later on. For the first 4 or 5 years, it literally changed. It was a place that, you know, that the guards, they weren't even carrying clubs in those days. Hmm. They were literally barred from having clubs anymore.
Hmm.
And if you, I don't know if you recall, but none of the guards throughout the entire system were literally walking around with clubs. The only ones that had clubs were guards that were going to literally take somebody out of the box. Or take somebody to the box, and
there was something called the Inmate Liaison Council,
right,
or Committee.
And that
was one of the post Attica Rebellion reforms as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also the Inmate Grievance Committee.
And what did they do? Those two operations. What were they about?
Well, if inmates had grievances about something, had they were being treated unfairly, they were. They had been assaulted and or given a kickback or something they didn't do, you would call for your grievance coordinator, and he would go and investigate it, and you could actually get a lieutenant, although they never really were fair about anything. But they would have a lieutenant would investigate your complaint. And so, like I said, I'm trying to cut it short, but for the first 5 years, they were literally really trying to make some reforms there to avoid any further Atticas, so to speak. So there was, you know, for the first period, about 5 years, they really tried to make a change. And did they succeed for that period? Yeah. But after that, they went right back to what they used to be.
And in the interim, the numbers swelled, right? I mean, at the time of Attica, the number of people in New York State prisons was just a fraction of what it was by the time you came back in the 90s, right?
When I first got there, it was like maybe 12 prisons in the state of New York. There weren't that many. And I'm not even sure how many actual inmates were in the system. But after that, like you said, all of a sudden we started getting inmates coming in, double selling, and it became a mess. It became a mess because you had this law and order, lock them up and throw away the key attitude, if you remember.
Right.
And that spilled over into the treatment of how the inmates were treated because, you know, it was a vindictive way. No longer were they trying to rehabilitate anybody. They just wanted to punish everybody as much as they could. It was all about, you know, all this education that we were asking for and schools and things like that.
All right. Well, you know, we could do a whole nother hour with Mr. Albert Victory about his remarkable saga and remarkable journey. We haven't talked about your own personal experiences, or at least outside of the 4 days of the Attica Rebellion very much. But at any rate, Al, there's going to be an online Zoom event that people starting, I think, at 6 p.m. here in New York that... I think that the website for the Alliance for Families for Justice has a Zoom link that people can tie into a couple of programs. And later this evening at 8 p.m., the Correctional Association of New York is having another program to honor the 50th anniversary of Attica. You know, one of the things that struck me when I went to Attica many years, obviously, after the rebellion, is that I went to one of the anniversary memorial services on September 13th. It was 2014, and it was a very somber occasion, and they were honoring all of the guards and other civilians who had been killed there, and all of their names are on a plaque in front of the prison, but there's no listing of the inmates who died. Their names are nowhere to be found outside of Attica prison today. And when you ask people why, they say, well, the inmates started the riot. It still remains a dark place, you know, a place still...
Well, let me say something else. It's a lot darker than that. All of those people, I would like to be forgiving and say, well, you know, we all made mistakes. And, you know, we started the riot, where you just said the rebellion. But it was them. They literally forced us to fight for some dignity. So, and they know this. They can tell you anything, and they will. They'll say, oh, they have to, because they can't live with what they did. They really can't live with what they did. And they have to lie to each other and to themselves. Because they murdered people and or crippled people. And, so, of course they don't put the names of the inmates there because they're the ones that murdered them. And they murdered their own people. The names that are in front of the Attica right now, all the guards and civilians, they should also have them there, all killed by the guards and from Attica here. That's who's responsible for that. We didn't do a damn thing to hurt anybody deliberately. You mentioned earlier that there might have been a couple of guards who had scratches on their neck, not cuts, not stabs, anything like that. But from what I understand, they had scratches.
Well, I think they're a little more serious than that. But at any rate, your point is well taken.
I didn't hear about it.
All right. Well.
But anyway,
Al, I want to thank you for taking the time here. I know that you're pressed for time and busy right now, and like I say, it'd be great to have you back to talk about more of the Al victory story. Let me just tell listeners that next week I'm going to do another Attica piece, this one with a woman named Deanne Quinn Miller, who's the daughter of William Quinn, who was the first official killed during the Attica Rebellion. He was a guard who was killed. She's written a book called The Prison Guard's Daughter. She'll be on with Gary Craig, a veteran reporter from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. Al Victory, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. All right. And
I'm going to quickly just say I hope I was at least interesting anyway. I hope I was able to give you a show that people could appreciate, even though I'm not as sharp as I used to be.
You're pretty sharp. If I can be as sharp as you are, Al, at your age, I'll be very, very happy. Thanks again, Al Victory. We're going to let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Oliver Nelson's fine tune, Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone.
Our 2021 election is getting underway. Listener democracy keeps our station connected to the people and accountable to you and listeners just like you. Look for your ballot in your email box from Simply Voting or a bright blue postcard. If you need a replacement ballot, visit elections.pacifica.org and file a ballot request form. Call 510-993-0320 if you need a paper ballot. Paper ballot requests are available till October 1st. Videos of candidate forums and introductions are at elections.pacifica.org to help you pick your favorites. Ballots are due back by October 15th.
Extinction Diaries. In the first 60 days of 2021, Florida lost between 7 and 8% of the state's manatee population. The Florida species is a West Indian manatee and on the endangered species list. Broward County was hit the hardest when a marine sanctuary turned into a manatee graveyard. Over 400 known manatee deaths occurred in that time, setting the stage for a staggering overtake of the previous record in 2013 when over one-fourth of the state's manatee population died. Although boat strikes are a factor, scientists say a lack of seagrass and uncontrolled pollution are the primary factors. The sugar industry that dominates the state's largest lake has contaminated waters so bad that controlled water releases into rivers that reach both coasts creates a toxic environment that has killed millions of fish, dolphins, reptiles, amphibians, birds, and manatees over the years. Although the animal has had miraculous comebacks from die-offs, the overall disintegration of Florida's waters put the immediate future of the gentle giant in irreversible peril. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th. In New York City, come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots from Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen. We're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us. Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. RisingTogether.info for more information.
Hi, this is DJ Baby K from The Sweet Spot. On the go, but want to support the station dedicated to you, the listener? No problem. Simply dial 41444 and text TRANSMIT 995 to make a pledge by text. Support WBAI's unique voice and keep us on the air during this critical time. Once again, dial 41444 and text TRANSMIT 995 to make your pledge. Thanks for supporting listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Trumpets were mellow, and every gal only had one fellow. No need to remember.
Hi, I'm David Kenny of Everything Old Is New Again. Every Sunday night at 10, please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again. Because everything old is new again. I like it.
Because everything old is new again.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org.